Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Well, hello, hello, and thank you for joining me again for Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am so excited to be here and get to talk to you about today's topic, which I really want to do today something a little different than what I've done so far on our podcast. And rather than have a guest join me today, it's just going to be me sharing some thoughts and some information, some knowledge and reflection with you that comes from APSAT's multidimensional partner trauma model. So APSATS, if you don't know, if you're a listener and you aren't familiar with APSATS, Betrayal Recovery Radio is the official podcast of APSATS. And APSATS is a nonprofit organization that stands for the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists. It's really the first organization out there that was proclaiming that partners of addicts, we can't just call them codependents. We can't just call them co-addicts. We can't understand their reactions to the discovery of secret betrayal and their partner's sex addictions as pathologies within them, family of origin issues within them, but to understand that that's really a trauma response that we're seeing, that the experience of betrayal is itself traumatic, and that began to address how do we actually help these individuals, men and women, who discover the betrayal of a partner who had a hidden sex addiction or chronic betrayal. How do we actually help these folks move forward out of the trauma and into healing and even post-traumatic growth? And so to that end, APSATS is an organization that trains people, trains coaches, trains therapists in what is called the multidimensional partner trauma model. And this model has essentially three phases for trauma treatment that go beyond this model, that have their origin in the work of someone named Judith Herman, who did a lot of research and treatment of victims of trauma. And so those three phases basically are, first, there is a phase of needing stability and needing safety first. After the discovery, the world's turned upside down, everything seems unsafe, everything is unstable, so we need to create safety, create stability. Then the second phase is about mourning the losses that have come with the discovery. What does this mean? It's really a grief process, grieving what this discovery has meant, what it has cost, how it is being sort of the meaning that is being made of it by this individual. And then finally, the third phase is about renewal and growth, finding new meaning and moving into that, into a new chapter, into post-traumatic growth. And today what I want to do is I want to focus primarily on that second phase, and as we do that, kind of talk about the similarities and the differences between phases one and two of this process of healing from betrayal trauma. And I want to start by sharing a poem. It's my favorite poem about grief. It's called Loss. It's by someone, a poet named Gregory Orr. That's O-R-R, in case you want to look him up. So here's Loss by Gregory Orr. Not the loss alone, but what comes after. If it ended completely at loss, the rest wouldn't matter. But you go on, and the world also. And words in a poem or a song, aren't they a stream on which your feelings float? Aren't they also the banks of that stream and you yourself the flowing? Now, I love this poem because I think it captures so many truths about the grief process, grief in general, but also grief particularly for betrayed partners. And so I just want to point out a few things from it that stand out as we get started here. The poem starts out, not the loss alone, but what comes after. And for so many women and men who have experienced the discovery of hidden betrayal, the discovery of a partner's sex addiction, it's not about that moment of discovery alone. It's not about what has come crashing down in that moment in isolation, but what comes after that. It's the now what. It's the, and how does this impact my relationship with my children, with my in-laws, with my church community, with my, you know, and on my neighbors. Not the loss alone, but what comes after. If it ended completely at loss, the rest wouldn't matter. You see, for so many who've been betrayed, life doesn't stop right there. They have to keep going. If life ended at the betrayal, which I've had partners in excruciating pain cry out, understandably, with angst, kind of asking their God, why, oh, why would you have me go on and live this way? But I think that's important to understand. It's what comes after the initial loss and the devastation that this person has to learn now to navigate. The poem goes on, but you go on and the world also. And so you continue moving through time. You continue moving forward, developing, being and becoming, and the world alongside you. And sometimes in light of the shattering of your reality, you want to say, hey, hold on, tap the brakes here. Hold on, I can't keep going. How can you keep going? How can, you know, maybe even looking at the one who did the betraying and saying, How can you keep showing up and performing at work? How can you keep interacting with our kids like that? How can you go and act like that at church when this has happened? And the world just keeps moving and they keep being carried along as well. The second half of the poem has a little bit of a shift and a little bit of a change in focus. It reads again, and words in a poem or a song, aren't they a stream on which your feelings float? And here, this is talking about the power of words, the power of narrative, of story, be it a poem, be it a song, to be a vehicle and an expression of what's happening as we and the world have to continue on in light of this loss and in light of how the world didn't completely end at that point. And the power of words as that vehicle for expressing our feelings floating on these words. We're going to talk a lot later in this podcast about the power of words and your story to move through grief. And then the final lines of the poem sort of shifts that metaphor of a stream. It shifts it slightly. So listen to these final words. Aren't they also, they being the words, aren't they also the banks of that stream and you yourself the flowing? So the words go from being the water in the stream on which our feelings float to the banks of the stream in which we're flowing. And so what that's talking about there is words acting as a container, right? Words containing the reality. Words acting as those banks that allow us to keep moving forward. So it's not spilled out everywhere, but there's there's a direction and there's forward movement. And oh, there is so much power in words, in story, to carry us forward in this process of grief. So that's what we're going to talk about today on Betrayal Recovery Radio. We're going to talk about grief. We're going to talk about the elements of grief, the stages of grief, not as you've necessarily heard them taught before. We're going to talk about the power of words and different ways of leveraging that power for healing, for processing of your feelings, for giving direction and shape to your own process of mourning. All right. Now, I want to just say this is going to get a little bit heady at times. I can't help it. If you didn't know this about me, in addition to being a licensed professional counselor and coach, I'm also a college professor, a seminary professor. So I teach at the master's level and doctoral level as an associate professor of counseling at Houston Graduate School of Theology, which is part of Kairos University. And so I'm going to kind of go full-blown professor mode here a little bit at various times. Look, if you don't grasp it all, that's okay. Keep going forward. And at times you may not like what I have to say, especially if you're earlier on in this process than that stage that I'm describing. That's okay too. I want you to take really good care of yourself. If that means you have to turn me off, okay? But my hope is that the knowledge that you can gain about grief and the grief process and how it relates to betrayal trauma, that knowledge will empower you to move forward in your own healing journey. All right? Okay. So I'd like to start off just with some basic terminology, okay? Some basic terminology. And I'm going to give you a few different words to learn here. And the first is bereavement, okay? Bereavement. Now, I grew up in a small town in the Texas Gulf Coast, went to a little Baptist church growing up, and this little Baptist church had all kinds of committees, right? It had the nursery committee. It had the flower committee. So the flower committee was in charge of making sure there were fresh flowers in the church every Sunday, right? Nursery committee, staffing of the nursery, all these different committees. There's the hospitality committee, and the hospitality committee would host the dinners on the ground after the service every so often and that kind of thing. Well, there was also this committee called the bereavement committee. And what the bereavement committee did was they would prepare, plan, and sometimes host a meal after a funeral. So if someone in the church had a loss in their family, a parent died, a spouse died, something like that, the bereavement committee would step in and host this meal after the funeral was conducted. And so I grew up thinking that bereavement was the meal after a funeral. That is not what bereavement really is. Bereavement, in the clinical sense, bereavement is the act of losing or being deprived of a loved one or a relationship. It's an objective act. It's a thing that happens. The bereavement happens. It's the loss. It's the act of losing or the act of being deprived. That is the bereavement proper. Okay, so that's the thing that happened. The act that happened is the bereavement. And then grief, properly understood, properly defined, is the process whereby we react to the bereavement. So the bereavement happens, the actual loss happens, and then we react to that loss with grief. And grief isn't an objective act. It's not a singular thing we do. It is a process in which we are engaged. Okay, it's a process in which we are engaged. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Now, there's another word that gets thrown around a lot that's highly related, and that is mourning. Not, you know, first thing when the sun comes up, not mourning, but mouring, mourning. And mourning is really the cultural response to grief and bereavement. This includes rituals and sort of overt processes for coping. So different cultures have different ways of moving through the grief process. And those rituals, those ways of moving through make up mourning. So for example, in my part of the country, and this is different in different parts of the country and obviously different from different parts of the world, in the South, and in my culture, what we did was there was the death, and then usually about 3 days later would be a viewing at a funeral home or maybe in a church, and people would come for the viewing, and then there would be a funeral service, usually the next day, sometimes later the same day of the viewing. So there'd be a service, a funeral service, and that service might have some music, and it would have a eulogy honoring the person's life, and it might have a sermon. And then there would be a final pass by the casket, and the casket would be closed, and then there would be a graveside service. And then after the graveside service would be this meal that the bereavement committee is hosting. And so there's just sort of this way of going about it, so that if someone chose not to engage in one of those steps, I'm not saying it was wrong or bad or whatever, but it was kind of noticeable because it wasn't following the normal process for the culture. That's mourning. That's how we mourn. Okay. Now, here's why I think it's important to understand these concepts as it relates to betrayal trauma. Because betrayal trauma is a very particular type of bereavement, right? You haven't necessarily lost a person. No one's necessarily died, right? And you're not even necessarily being deprived of a person. No one's taken from you. What has been lost is something different, and actually something multidimensional. Hence, APSAT's appropriately named multidimensional partner trauma model, right? And so the grief that then follows this unusual, or it's not actually unusual, it's more undefined within the culture, less acknowledged within the culture. The process of grief that follows doesn't have a cultural script. It doesn't have a set way of being mourned, right? And there's actually a whole category of grief that describes this experience. It's called disenfranchised grief. DOKA, D-O-K-A, is the name of one of the first researchers to talk about this concept of disenfranchised grief. Disenfranchised grief is what is experienced when the loss is not or cannot be publicly acknowledged or mourned, right? When the loss is not or cannot be publicly acknowledged or mourned. And so what we've got here is we've got this significant bereavement that's happened, this tremendous loss, but it is not or cannot be publicly grieved. There's no publicly acceptable, culturally expected, culturally carved out way of moving through the grief process. And so what this means then is that now I've got this tremendous loss, and I don't have the help of my society, those around me, which are incredibly important to humans, to help me move through the process. Sometimes grieving individuals disenfranchise themselves because of fear or because of shame, right? If I share what happened to me, will my husband lose his job? If I share my wife's betrayal against me, if it's a male betrayed partner, if I share my wife's betrayal against me, how will people think about me as a man? So there's lots of fears. you know, will we lose our place in our church? Will our friends turn their backs on me? Will my mother start to hate my husband if I tell her what he did to me? I don't want that, because despite this huge betrayal and the pain, I think I want to stay with him. I want to save my marriage. So can I tell my mother about this, or will that poison her against him? You know, all of these things, there's no set way in our culture of marking this traumatic event and the loss that grows out of it. There's fear about what would it be like to grieve this publicly, to bring this into the light. Or there's shame. Right? There's shame. And the shame can be about, how could I let this happen to me? I should have known. And so many of these other thoughts that betrayed partners can get into. Another reason that many betrayed partners disenfranchise themselves, and they'll do this even in spaces that are safer for them to grieve the betrayal, is that the loss is so complex. So I've actually got this black diamond here. It's actually a paperweight that a betrayed partner and her husband gave me. It's really pretty, and you can't really see it right now, but the light does shine through it despite it being black like this. But it's multifaceted. There are all these cuts on this diamond, all these facets to this thing. And that's often how it is for a betrayed partner. There's not just the loss of trust. There's also the loss of the love story that he or she thought that they had. There's also the loss of maybe a friend. If friends knew, there were some friends that maybe knew about the betrayal, and those people no longer feel safe. There's that loss. If a faith community doesn't provide support, but instead maybe shames or invalidates the loss. There's the loss maybe of that faith community and the expected response. There could be the loss of an expected future. This isn't the vision I had for retirement. This isn't the vision I had for us becoming parents together, or whatever it is. So there's so many losses, one upon another, upon another, upon another, that betrayed partners often won't share them all, because they feel like, if I go there, if I open up, there would be no end to it. It would be overwhelming. I would overwhelm and scare away these people. Yeah, I can share this much or that much. I can share a little bit here, a little bit there. But there's way more than I could ever fully share. And so they partially disenfranchise themselves by not sharing the fullness of the bereavement and its impact and the grief that they're feeling. I want to talk now about why it is that being betrayed, feeling the trauma of betrayal, and then moving through the grief after betrayal can make people feel so crazy, so weak, like they're messed up, something's wrong with them. I've heard so much from betrayed partners about how they feel and their judgments of themselves after this experience. And this is going to get a little bit wonky, a little bit technical, and I'm sorry about that. But I want to explain the neurobiology of betrayal trauma, and grief, the distinctions and the overlap among all of these. And so we're going to start by talking about betrayal trauma and comparing betrayal trauma to PTSD. So it's thankfully getting more commonly known out there that the experience of betrayal is traumatic. It's not a pathology of codependence or co-addiction. Betrayal is traumatic, and there's been a lot of research done. I think about Barbara Steffens, who founded APSATS and was the first president of APSATS, and her research on the symptoms of women who had experienced betrayal trauma and comparing those to the symptoms of PTSD. Incredible findings there that really have radically shifted the field. Yet, there is a very significant difference, generally speaking, there can always be exceptions, but generally speaking, between betrayal trauma and PTSD, and that is in the symptom of what is called or I call it anyway, forced historical review. Forced historical review. And here's what's meant by that. In PTSD, what is typically found is an effort to avoid thinking about the trauma, okay? And so even in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which has the criteria for different mental health disorders, within the criteria for PTSD, there's a whole category on avoidance. That's how predominant avoidance is. But with betrayal trauma, what we actually see is something different. While, yeah, many betrayed partners do try to avoid trauma triggers being triggered, what they don't avoid is looking at the traumatic event itself, which is the betrayal. In fact, what we see is a sort of forced historical review. The questions that circle over and over and over and over and over again. Okay, and so this is happening because the hippocampus, all right, within the brain, which is the part of the brain that is putting together our memories in sequence, okay? The hippocampus is having to review and having to recontextualize the past that we knew with the new information about our past, right? So the story that I had about my life no longer works in light of all this new information I have that was left out of the story that I had. So the story I had is shattered, and now all this additional information has to be integrated with what I know. The problem is I'm questioning what I know. How do I know what I know? Because what I thought I knew wasn't so. And so what we have is this circling. But what? But you were where? But what? But no, but that didn't happen. But did it? But was that real? But where were you? But you said this. But how does that fit with that? And it's going back and back. And so partners often, betrayed partners often go to the ones who betrayed them with the same questions again and again, and asking it again, because now they've got one new piece and they're trying to make it fit with that. They are trying to reconstruct a narrative of the past. Why? Because the brain's number one job is to keep us alive and safe. Alive and safe, safe and alive. And how do I anticipate the future if I don't know the past? And so it is through an understanding of the past that I can anticipate my future. And if I am hypervigilant to threat because I have just discovered this threatening information, how can I anticipate future threat if I don't understand how the past threats and harms happened? And so the hippocampus is working overtime, circling, trying to process, trying to gather, trying to assemble, trying to align and order all that data and put it there so that I can anticipate future threat. Now, that is happening with betrayal trauma. Now, let's talk about grief. We're going to shift suddenly and talk about the neurobiology of grief. What is happening in the grief process? Well, grief takes place across many regions of the brain, okay? A distributed neural network, okay, that affects all kinds of things like affect processing. That's how you feel what you feel in your body, how you know and experience what you're feeling in your body. It affects the neural network that's a part of mentalizing, which is the basis of like empathy, you know, me understanding what you're thinking, anticipating what you're thinking, being able to empathize with you. Episodic memory retrieval, so being able to recall certain things and events, being able to process faces, the processing of other visual imagery. Autonomic regulation, so going into fight or flight, regulating myself, coming up out of numbness, all of that, and the modulation and the coordination of all of those functions, that's all part of grief. Grief is flowing through all of these parts of the brain affecting the functioning of these parts of the brain. In fact, what we see is that there is less connectivity among the different parts and these different systems in the brain as a result of grief. It's like it's been rattled kind of loose, and so there's not the efficiency there that there should be. And so what's happening there is there's this bogging down and this fogginess and this slowness and this sense of detachment. But also it's coupled with this intense feeling that I have a hard time regulating and that sort of thing. And that's what's happening in the grief process neurobiologically. Now, so we talked about betrayal trauma with that hippocampal review. That's very different than what I just described going on neurobiologically with the grief process. But where's their overlap? Well, there's some very significant overlap neurobiologically. And it comes back again to that hippocampus, okay? The hippocampus. So there was a study that was done of bereaved parents in China who had lost a child to China's one-child-only policy. They did fMRIs on these parents, and they found atrophy in the left hippocampus. So that left hippocampus severely affected by the bereavement, by the loss, the grief. Interestingly, when they compared of those people in the study, those with PTSD and those without PTSD, there was no significant difference. So what that means is this hippocampal effect connects from the trauma experience through the grief experience. Okay? And so the review of what is this thread that goes through the initial trauma, and even when you come out of that initial trauma place. So again, think about those phases in the APSATS multidimensional partner trauma model. Phase one, safety and stability. That's where there's still more hypervigilance, lots of triggers, lots of need for safety and structure and boundaries and all of that. And then you get that in place, you move into phase two, there's increasing safety, increasing stability, movement into the grief. What continues through that is this hippocampal review process, though there are some significant shifts in what's happening. So in the trauma process, in phase one, when the brain is seeking safety and stability, the review there is about what happened. Give me the data. Give me the files so I can order them in this file cabinet, okay, so that I can sequence them, so that I can have a story, all right? That is initially what's going on. That's the first part. I want to know what happened. Get me the data. This is why the disclosure process, the process of a full therapeutic disclosure, whereby the one who did the betraying, whose acts were hidden and kept from the betrayed partner, in an appropriate way, with the support of trained professionals, it gives the betrayed partner a full disclosure, a full accounting of the betrayal, of what happened, at an appropriate level of detail and all that good stuff. And so that data is given. And I have seen it happen overnight. And I've seen this multiple times in the work that I do with couples. When we do disclosures with them go from the morning of day one, super hypervigilant, lots of destabilization, lack of security. They get the disclosure that day. By the time they show up for the morning of day two, I'm not saying it's perfect at all, but so much more. I felt sense of relief, not because they necessarily like what they learned, but at least they know. And there's a quieting that happens in the brain, okay? Because the brain isn't going, but what? But how did this fit with that? And where, right? So there's this quieting that happens. So now all the data is in place. Now move to phase two, the process of grieving and mourning. This is a meaning-making process. Now I have to say to myself, okay, I've got the data of what happened. What does that mean? What does this mean? And that is where the grief really begins. Okay, that's where the grief really begins. And so now it's about making sense of what happened, which you'll never make sense of things that are so senseless, but coming to see it and make meaning of it. I'll talk more about that in just a moment. So to kind of sum it up on the neurobiology piece, the effects, the summative effects of the neurobiology, the consequences of betrayal and grief are that there's at first a destabilization of safety and security, because the past, that which I have to anticipate future threat, isn't there. And so that has to be rebuilt. So there's an uncertainty around reality. And then even once I begin to have that take shape, an uncertain meaning, what does that mean? What does that mean about this world, about you, about our purpose in this world, all of that? And then that's related to my identity. Who am I? Because I know who I am by my place in this world, by how I experience other relationships and what's given to me in relationships, what's mirrored to me. That starts from very early on in childhood. You know, what's mirrored to us as children and then how we're responded to begins to shape in us our identity. So when my world is rattled or shattered, my identity is also often in question. My purpose is in question. Who you are, how I understand you, and the relationship between us is in question. So all of this has been turned up and tossed up with the experience of grief. Okay. Now, there's one more concept that that I want to talk about as we move forward here and talk about the goal of grief. So I'm saying here that grief is essentially a meaning-making process, okay? It's a meaning-making process. What is this meaning that we're making, though? Well, it's about the construction of something called an assumptive reality. We have to come up with a new assumptive reality. So what's the assumptive reality? Well, it is our default understanding of the world that has to be reworked in light of the loss. So I want you to think about this with me. If I have never known the world without my mom, and then I lose my mom, I have to restructure the world as I know it. If I have counted on my partner for years, even decades, and had a certain assumption about the world in which we habit and my relationship to this partner, and they're such a huge part of my world, and then I find out that wasn't true, I have to come up with a new understanding of the world, a new assumptive reality, a new default understanding of what this world is and how it works. And I want to say this doesn't necessarily correspond to length of time. I've worked with betrayed partners who had been with the partner with the addiction or the partner who committed the betrayal for 5 decades, 6 decades. I've worked with partners who were only in the relationship for 2 years, you know, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. And let me tell you something, that does not necessarily affect the extent of the trauma. Why? Because if I have given myself over in my assumptive reality over to the idea that this person and I are it. We are it. We've got one another's backs. We're both all in for life, and my life is going to look a certain way. It's still the change of an assumptive reality. And I'm going to make this analogy. If someone loses a child at, you know, 8 months, a year, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, no one thinks, oh, well, it's not that bad. At least the kid wasn't 20 years old, because then it would be really bad. No. Why? Because when the moment that child comes on the scene, the assumptive reality of the parent shifts around that child being, you know, kind of the center of things, or a center of things at least, right? And it's the same way in any relationship that becomes a primary relationship. And so the loss is not, and the sense of loss and the trauma and the grief that follows does not necessarily correspond to the length of time that the person has been in that relationship. So the goal of grief is that in light of the shattered reality, assumptive reality that I had, I have to construct a new one. I have to formulate a new story, a new narrative that negotiates a new sense of this world and who I am in this world, my place in this world, my place with you, if you're still in this world of mine. And so in the context of relational betrayal, grief requires a story that answers these questions. What is this world? You know, and this can sound like, why would God allow this to happen? Why did this have to happen? Are all men this way? Or are all women this way? Or that kind of thing. So what is this world? Second question, who are you? Who are you that you could do this to me? Who are you that you could look me in the face and lie to me? Who are you that you could be one person in this moment and this other completely different person in the next moment? So who are you? And then who am I? Who am I that I didn't catch it? Who am I that I'm someone who could have this happen to them? Who am I that you could do this to me? And then what is the nature of our relationship? Right? What is this? What was it? What is it? What can it be? Right? These are the questions that have to be navigated as the grief process is moved through after betrayal. And what's interesting is you can't like take them in order, because as you begin to see an answer emerge from one of these questions, it will necessarily impact the answers to all these other questions. So they all have a reciprocal influence on one another. Who you are affects who I see myself as. The nature of our relationship says something about who I am and what this world is. And what this world is says something about who I am and the nature of our relationship. All these things play off each other. And so we're moving through all of these questions at once, them going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. All right. Now, some ground rules for grief work. Just some basic principles that I think we have to adopt in order to move through grief. And the first is this: every single grief involves a death. Every grief involves a death, okay? It doesn't have to be the physical death of a person or a pet, a loved one, you know. But something has died. So in the case of betrayal, that can be a lot of different things. But what I hear most often is that what has died is a couple of things. Number one, the story we shared as I knew it. So our love story, which doesn't necessarily have to be or have been a fairy tale, something perfect. There are problems, there are challenges, but it was our story, and that is gone in light of what I now know. The other thing that often dies is hopes and dreams for the future. I had an expectation that life was going to be this with you, that we were, just as an example, we were about to retire and we were going to do the grandparent thing and we were going to travel around, and now I don't know if I want to be in an RV with you, and I don't know if our grandparents will get to, or our grandchildren will get to enjoy us as grandparents together, and I don't know how much money I'm going to have to spend on therapy, and is that going to enable us to do what we wanted to do? And so there's this loss of an anticipated future and the dreams attached to that that is often gone. That's ground rule number one. Every grief involves a death. Number two, things will never be the same. Things will never be the same. They'll never go back to how they were. And this is where I say to any of you who are listening who did the betraying, that you can't just say, oh, I'll never do that again, and think that you're going to be able to pick up where things left off, even if, in fact, you never do it again. Because that old marriage, that old relationship is dead. So things will never be the same. Your betrayed partner will never be able to unknow what she or he now knows about their own story that for so long they did not know. So things will never, ever be the same. And then ground rule number three is this. And here's the one that if you're early in this process, you may want to, you know, disagree with me, shake your fist at me. You might even turn this podcast off. That's okay. Bookmark it, because maybe you'll come back to it later on in your journey. And ground rule number three is that things can be different and maybe even better. So now that we've talked about kind of those ground rules for grief work, let's transition that over into phases of grief work. And I see three phases that we have to move through, and they actually align with those ground rules. So the first ground rule, remember, every grief involves a death. Phase one is about answering the question, what is dead? The second ground rule, things will never be the same. So phase two is about what is new, answering the question, what is new? And I want to be clear about this. Asking what's new is not expecting the answers to all be good, all be pleasant, all be sunshine and rainbow. Sometimes what's new are really hard things. And then the third phase of grief work corresponds to the third rule. Things can be different, even better. So phase three is answering the question, what's next? So those three questions, what is dead, what is new, what is next? And another thing I want to be clear about, you don't, you know, go to sleep in phase one and wake up in phase two, never to return. There's overlap here. There's some back and forth here. It's not an entirely linear process, right? But those are the questions, the targets. What's dead? What's new? What's next? So what I want to give you now are some ideas on some ways of moving through this grief work if you've experienced betrayal. So the first thing I want to say about that is ask yourself, are you ready? And here's some markers for that. If you're still living a lot of your life in that state of hypervigilance, hyperarousal, you know, like your nervous system is on fire, on edge. If you're still experiencing lots and lots of trauma triggers, then you may not yet be ready to start grief, because it sounds like there's still a need for safety and stability. That first part of the APSATS model, safety and stability. So what additional boundaries, what additional support, what additional like self-regulation and grounding tools might you be able to use to begin to lower some of that reactivity? And then what I think you'll begin to notice is a transition from trauma triggers to what I call grief waves. And here's how I distinguish between those two. When I talk about trauma triggers with someone, I kind of put my hands up around my head and kind of shake it like it's up here. It's this in my mind, like on alert. My eyes are darting back and forth. I'm looking around. I'm hypervigilant, you know, kind of taken outside of myself and just looking all around for the threat. That's trauma trigger versus a grief wave, where I'm going to put my hands lower down in my body. It's a deeper experience of more like pain, a deeper experience of loss, a deeper experience of sadness or fear or even anger. Okay, but it's not that ringing, hypervigilant, in my mind, racing thoughts kind of thing. It's a deeper, it wells up within me. You know, being in grief is like wading out into the waters of the ocean. Okay, I'm going to wade out into the waters of the ocean. And when I'm there, I'm having the waters hit me. You know, I've kind of waded out to where they're hitting me at my chest. And then sometimes all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this big wave comes and smacks me upside the head out of nowhere. It just comes up and surprises me. That's often what happens in grief. I'm doing okay. I've been having a good day, a good week. And then seemingly out of nowhere, welling up from within me is a wave of sadness, a wave of loss, a wave of anger, a wave of fear, a wave of shame, or whatever it is. So if you've begun to experience a little bit of that transition where you're coming down out of the hypervigilance of the trauma and more feeling more of the deeper, intense emotions of grief, then maybe it's time to start doing in a really intentional way some formal grief work. So here's some ideas for that. One thing that you can do is a loss timeline. And there are a few different ways of doing this, but here's the one I usually assign to clients, is make two timelines. One is life as you knew it, the story you knew. The second is what you found out. And when you make them, don't just write them down on pieces of paper. create them out of something. So I've had clients use index cards and yarn. One client actually took shirts from different t-shirts from different phases of her life and created a rope out of these t-shirts and then pinned to it pictures of life, the life she knew and what was happening that she didn't know about. And then begin to take one piece at a time, just one, not the whole thing at once, but one piece at a time, and think about what it means to bring those together. Now, that sounds excruciating and painful, and it is. It is, but it's facing it. What does it mean that these things coexisted? And I would recommend you do that with a group, with support, with someone else who you can process that with, who can hold that with you. So various forms of timeline work can be really helpful. Another thing you can do is use art. Draw, okay? Draw your grief. Draw a picture. You don't have to be a great artist. It's not about that. It's about connecting with another part of yourself. And maybe, you know, I've seen pictures of landscapes that are devastated. I've seen pictures of houses. I've seen self-portraits. I've seen so many different things. It doesn't really matter what you draw as long as it's an expression of what you're feeling as you're trying to make sense of and make meaning out of what's happened to you. So just spending some time with creativity and then taking that and, again, getting support around the processing of that, sharing that with a group, sharing that with a safe person. Journaling can be effective, but they've actually done a lot of research about what it is that makes journaling effective and how to do effective journaling. Journaling that is not effective is either where you journal for like an hour at a time and it's actually leaving you more revved up and more wound up and more on edge than you were before, and then you just like put it down and you know, either stay in that place or try to stuff it. Here are some instructions for effective journaling. Journal for 15 minutes a day for 4 days in a row. Okay, so you're going to set a timer and you're going to do free association journaling. So a prompt might start with this. As I remember my 10th anniversary, when I also consider what I know now about what was really happening, I feel ... And just let yourself write. Free association, 15 minutes. You do that 4 days in a row. Now, each day, spend some time transitioning afterwards. Don't just shut the journal and move on. But actually take time to transition. You can do that by listening to a song or doing some mindfulness work or some breath work. But take a few minutes, you know, 3 or 4 minutes to transition afterwards. If you want, you could add some bilateral stimulation. If you're familiar with EMDR, you know about bilateral stimulation. So if you've got like tappers or something like that, or music that does bilateral stimulation, left, right, you could be listening to that while you do the journaling. So 15 minutes a day, 4 days in a row, transition afterwards, maybe add that bilateral stimulation. That, research shows, can really make a difference in moving you along in that processing of emotion, okay? Look for a metaphor, all right? Is there a metaphor that you can really latch onto that helps to communicate your experience of grief? One couple that I worked with talked about standing over the grave together. I've got another couple who talk about a wall in their home that they wanted to paint, and they never painted it, and so they refer to it as, you know, the unpainted wall or whatever. So, you know, but there are several unpainted wall moments. So listen for within yourself, within your conversations. Is there something that can become symbolic that you keep coming back to? Because what that's doing is that's connecting these various experiences around a theme, around this metaphor and the meaning of that metaphor. And it's through the connection of the experiences that the new story begins to emerge. Read poetry, read plays, dive into literature. That can also open us up to new ways of seeing and processing experiences. And then one last thing is there a ritual of remembrance? Do you need to call your support group together, your friends together, and have a little funeral service, a memorial service of some sort for some piece of what you're grieving? Is there a way of marking reminders monthly or yearly or to whatever frequency seems appropriate to you around significant days or significant events that happen? So those are some different ways that you can do grief work. Also, look for grief groups that are betrayal trauma informed. They're certainly out there. And the APSATS directory is filled with therapists and coaches who know how to move through this work. Like I said, grief is a central part of the APSATS multidimensional partner trauma model. And so if this sounds like something you're ready to do, find someone to walk with you along this journey. It can really help you to move through it. I'm not going to say pain-free, because there's going to be pain, but hopefully in a way that is most effective and that maximizes your efforts and that gets you to that place of growth and newness sooner rather than later, though we're all going to take whatever time it takes. And listen, you know, maybe you've been listening and you think, I want to know more about this. And this is something that maybe I've already gone through it, but I've never thought about it this way. Maybe I'd like to lead other people through this. Well, hey, if you're someone who thinks that you might want to work with those who've experienced betrayal trauma, maybe you would want to consider taking the APSATS Multidimensional Partner Trauma training. It's a 4-day training. There's one coming up in June. Maybe you're a religious leader. You're part of a faith community. We've got another training that is for you folks. It's not as in-depth necessarily, but would help you better know how to support and come alongside those who are dealing with the consequences of betrayal. Go to APSATS.org, and I encourage you to just look into that, investigate that, and see if that might be a good fit for you. So, hey, as I wrap up this episode, I want to leave with some words of encouragement. Grief is hard, but grief is where the healing happens. Grief, yes, something has died, but I've seen it happen. I felt it happen in my own life. Where there's death, there can be resurrection. After wintertime comes the spring, right? The phoenix rises from the ashes. There's so many metaphors from so many cultures across time and around the world that testify to the fact that within human beings, there's something inside of us that somehow passes through loss and finds new life and growth. And you may be there, you may have been listening to me, and you may think, that is the furthest thing from what I see happening for me. I can't see it. I can't see it. I can't see that light at the other end of this dark place where I find myself. I hear you. I do. And what I want to do is I want to hold the hope for you until you get to that place. But don't give up. Move forward. Ask for help. You are not alone. There's a whole army of people, APSATS trained coaches and therapists and others who are waiting to rally around you, to cheer you on, to carry you on when you feel like you can't walk, and help you get to that place of new life and restoration and healing and growth. So don't give up, all right? Hey, thank you so, so much for listening. It's my hope that this has been a source of encouragement, empowerment through knowledge, and help to you. Reach out to me anytime, jake@absats.org. And I look forward to seeing you next time on Betrayal Recovery Radio. You've been listening to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS. If you've received help or hope from this episode, I encourage you to share it with someone you know. If you've not yet done so, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platform. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and you can always email me directly at jake@apsats.org. I'd love to hear your ideas, questions, or comments about the show. Until next time, keep choosing to use your voice and live your values. It's good for you and for this world.